Good morning. Welcome to Shattering Myths, the program that's devoted to those of you who, like me, have come to realize, or at least to those of you who have come to question, the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions, and think that there is the possibility that they are corrupt, even counterproductive. I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us anytime over the next couple of hours, is 877-300-7645. Yesterday we were talking about Greece and the fact that Greece gave up its sovereignty to receive another influx of cash. That the Greek problem was not resolved. The problem of Greece is as it always was, which is the same problem that is harming really all of the Western-based countries, the countries that are based on fiat money. And that would be throughout Europe and throughout the Americas and most of Asia. That politicians get elected by promising the majority of the voters indulgences. We could call them safety net, you could call them welfare, you could call it free health care, nationalized health care, whatever you want to call it, but they're indulgences. They're support programs for those who have not been responsible for their own well-being or who, for whatever reason, have chosen not to work. Now, I understand there's some people who want to work and are not able to work. And for a transitional period, I'm all for helping them. And I'm not even opposed, but I'm actually extraordinarily positive on the idea of creating an environment where those who are chronically out of work have the opportunity to work for their well-being. They want to receive food, they'll work in the food kitchen. They want to have a place to sleep. It would be done like a university campus, but they're going to work evenings and weekends in the facility. And if they want anything that is in this regard, close. They can contribute to those who supply them. So I'm in favor of people making a contribution to their own well-being, but never giving anyone cash. So this mentality, though, that you can create a great society by giving people who have not earned it money, it destroys the character of those who receive it. And that's why in Greece, the Greeks are blaming everyone other than themselves for their plight. And what they gave up is their sovereignty. Now, do they care? Probably not. You know, people who have become dependent on government handouts, whether they be pensions or Social Security, nationalized health care or Medicare or Medicaid, those kinds of individuals who have given up their independence to become dependent on government have already crossed that Rubicon. And they're already in the position where they've acquiesced their free will. They've acquiesced personal responsibility. And so now they're just giving it up on a national basis as opposed to just an individual basis. But that's the thing that has caused the problem in Greece. And what I wanted to share was that the next domino to fall in this regard is Italy. Italy is the next most bankrupt nation. And so here is a story that focuses really on Rome, the capital of Italy, as opposed to the whole country, but listen to how it is being presented. Dirty and disorganized, Rome is once again in decline. that decline of Rome is the fall of Rome is talked about in terms of how the Vandals and the Visigoths came in successive raids to pummel Rome. And Rome was defenseless long before the Goths, Visigoths, and others, the Vandals, came in to ransack her. And she was ransacked because she had for centuries ransacked and pillaged everyone within march of the Roman legions. And so Rome simply got what was coming. And Rome had long since stopped working. They had all manner of entitlement programs, and the treasury of Rome was so bankrupt that they began producing coins that were no longer pure gold or silver, and they began shaving their coins, and they began making their coins of lighter weight, and they did everything they could to create the illusion that they were solvent. But trying to control the world had essentially bankrupt Rome. And so Rome declined from inside. Its decline was not precipitated by outsiders, but instead from inside. It was a moral decay, a decay of personal responsibility, a decay of national politics and religion. This goes on to say, City Hall is paralyzed by allegations of mafia infiltration. Basic services are in tatters. The main airport is partially closed, and wildcat strikes have frayed an already ropey public transport network. Well, here's the kind of the underpinning, the undercurrent of all of that. The things that continue to happen in a society like what you're seeing in Greece and Rome is the pensions continue to be paid. The national health care continues to be funded. The welfare systems continue intact. And those who work in the public sector continue to be grossly underworked and overpaid. And during this, they still manage to shortchange the things that the taxpayer is actually funding that they ought to, for their taxes, have work. You know, things like City Hall, things like airports, things like transportation systems. But no, those are the things that are always shortchanged, and those are the things that are all too often managed by public sector workers who, as I say, are often incompetent, often underworked, often overcoddled, and almost always overpaid. It is in overpaying and overcompensating through pensions and medical care and the like, and cutting the hours of public workers that politicians get elected, particularly on the left. And we have gone through a period in America, just as they have now in Europe, in Greece and in Italy. This is the single biggest problem contributing to their demise, and it's very true in the United States, particularly in states like New York and California, where if you were to go back 20 years ago, 30 years ago, a public sector employee was paid on average one-third to one-half of a private sector employee. And that differential was appropriate because the risk associated with the private sector job and the demands placed on the private sector employee were so much greater. You know, I've always been engaged in the private sector. I would show up at work at before 7 o'clock. I would very seldom leave before 7 o'clock. I would work 6 days a week. And I would travel on my own time so that I could work those hours in whatever the locale was that I was traveling to. It is the nature of the of being in private practice. And you do whatever is required when it's required. But yet in public practice, the jobs start at 9. You get prescribed breaks, and it's a matter of a completely different mindset in that environment. And so the requirements of a private sector employee in terms of their job performance, the employer's position regarding them, where they're fired if they are not competent, these things are not true in the public sector. They work shorter hours, they work fewer days, they have less responsibility, less accountability, and yet over the last 15 to 20 years, politicians have changed the relative pay and benefit scale so that now public sector employees are paid 2 to 3 times more than their counterparts in private practice, even though they produce less and less is expected of them. So this is the problem. Now, this goes on to say, for generations, the Italian capital has rested on past glories rather than built on them. The years of neglect, corruption, and bureaucratic bungling have taken a fierce toll, reflecting a wider malaise that affects Italy as a whole. This would be true of a number of countries, like Egypt, for example. Everything that you would want to see in Egypt was built long before Islam infected the place. In Italy, the only things worth seeing were either constructed by the Romans, which were vicious, and you're looking at their ruins. Most of their ruins have been pummeled, though, because the Roman Catholic Church took the stones that were used to construct Rome and turned those stones and granite and the like into hideously ugly churches. But there is so little progress in these countries, so little worth seeing, so few places worth going, that a place like Rome, you know, other than seeing the decadence, the repulsive nature of the Colosseum, and what little is left of the old Roman Forum, why would you go to Rome? And it's a giant trash heap that's unsafe. The article continues with a quote, "Rome is on the verge of collapse." This is a quote from the president of Rome's Chamber of Commerce. It's unacceptable that a major city which calls itself developed can find itself in such a state of decay. Welcome to the world. This will be the state of every major city in the world. The fact is that Athens has been in this condition for some time. Italy is the next domino to fall, and so we should not be surprised that the collapse of these countries economically is, and morally really, begins with their largest cities. Rome is next. And there is no way to resolve these problems. Rome will be the next country to lose its autonomy. And it's kind of interesting that this is that southern tier of countries that's right along the Mediterranean, and it's the northern tier of European countries that are funding them and yet controlling them, because what you're going to eventually see is this divestiture, if you will. And you're going to see an alliance of southern European countries that will be particularly receptive to anyone that offers them hope. And this is part of that 10-nation confederacy that Yahushua spoke about in Revelation. This is part of what Daniel had told us about, that was going to shape the last 7 years on this planet. And it's obvious that the Torahless one is going to come from Macedonia. and that he is going to form an alliance of some of those small countries that broke away either from Czechoslovakia or from, more likely, Yugoslavia, and that out of Macedonia, out of the pieces that have now become the countries divided out of Yugoslavia and Macedonia, you'll see the initial confederation. But that confederation grows to 10 nations, and the likelihood of Greece and Italy being part of it, I think, is extraordinarily high. And there were, for so long, people that used to take the European Union or the Euro area and say, well, you know, that's approximately 10 nations, and that'll be the confederation. But that's just not the case. And and soon, of course, the number of nations in the European Union was more than double the 10, and the number in the euro is triple the 10, and so it was obvious that wasn't the case, although, you know, a lot of Christian writers continue to promote it, but primarily because they don't spend enough time looking in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. But I do see that these decay with the next domino to fall being Italy after Greece. The one after that will be either Spain or Portugal, one after the other. And you're going to have a southern tier that collapses financially, that will be particularly susceptible to someone offering them new hope, somebody that comes with an economic plan that confiscates the wealth of those who have saved money and have been responsible and those who are productive, and grants complete loan relief, elimination of all debt for those that acquiesce, that submit to his new plan, his new currency, his new policy, economic policy. And so in Greece and in Rome, we're seeing these dominoes line up. We had spent considerable time with IQ Al-Rasuli about a week ago talking about the common word and this notion that the love of God and the love of neighbor was a common word that united Islam and Christianity, and that Yale was promoting this with the signatories of some 300 Christians. And I wanted to continue it because there's more meat on that bone. What we demonstrated in our previous discussion was that there is absolutely no statement anywhere in the Quran that tells Muslims to love God or tells Muslims to love their neighbor. There's no place anywhere in the Quran or in the Hadith, for that matter, where Allah is shown as loving or Allah is shown as wanting to be loved. Allah is a fearsome God. Allah spends all of his time in hell. Allah presents himself as a terrorist. Love, as it is presented in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, doesn't exist there. So the whole basis of Yale's initiative, the politically correct university, their theology center, and this some 100 Muslim clerics and 300 Christian clerics, is to promote a myth. And the myth is that their common word between Islam and Christianity is a love of God and a love of one's neighbors. In the Quran, there is no mention of love towards God. And there is no mention of God loving or of man loving God. And in the Quran, there is no mention of men loving their neighbors. The Quran is a book written to instruct Muslims to rob, enslave, plunder, and kidnap their neighbors. That's not very loving. And if you look at the history of Islam, that's what Islam has done. And so they're trying to make this myth that there's this commonality of the two when there is no commonality. They're opposites in this regard, and they know it because one of the first questions that they present, the statements are actually presented as a question is, you know, is love presented in the Quran the same way it's presented in the Bible? And the answer they knew was no. So they all they would say is, well, you know, that's a good question, and you know, we should let our Muslim clerics decide for themselves what how their religion is going to project love, because they know for a fact that it's not there. And so there is no commonality here. These are exclusive sets. But that's the problem with political correctness. That which is exclusive is considered common. That which is common is considered exclusive. It's the antithesis of true. And they know it. Well, this next statement was, what do we hope to gain from this dialogue? And it says, the Yale response and upcoming dialogue take seriously God's admonition to us through Paul. Well, therein is a problem. God didn't admonish us to do anything through Paul. God didn't inspire Paul. He didn't speak through Paul. Everything that Paul said was inspired by the same wannabe spirit of Islam, Satan. So it's Satan's admonition through Paul. And if Paul, this is from Romans 12:18, you know, stuff right between Romans 7, where Paul equates the Torah to a deceased husband, of which people are no longer accountable, and his admonition that one should submit to the Roman government, the most despicable institution on the planet at the time. And so in 12, he says, if possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all people. But that's not what the Torah says. Now, the Torah is very different. And rather than saying that you should reconcile with and be reconciled with all people, it says don't emulate the ways of the Gentiles. And Paul, of course, was the opposite of this. He was extraordinarily critical, condemning of his brethren, of Jews, and of, in particular, the disciples. He went to war against them, and he was extraordinarily condemning of those who rejected his testimony. So he is being a complete hypocrite here. But, you know, Yahweh, rather than us reconciling relationships with and being in relation with and harmony with Gentiles, wants us to walk away from Babel, to disassociate. So this is Pauline's mantra being the antithesis of Yahweh's instructions, and therefore they're seeking to use Paul to create the basis of their agenda, because you can't do it with God. It says, in addition, we pray that our Muslim brothers will see the beauty of Jesus in us. There is no Jesus. There is a Yahusha, but he bears no resemblance whatsoever to the Christian Jesus. And that, in fact, the prophetic portrayal of him, there was nothing that was particularly beautiful about him. He was very common. And that Muslims and Christians alike may learn more about the love of Jesus. Well, you know, the fact is that Yahusha hated religion. He didn't love religion. He didn't love the religious. He hated those who promoted religion. You know, just read what he had to say prior to the Olivet Discourse, wherein Matan Yom, Matthew 23, he goes on the longest, most critical diatribe of his entire public ministry, and specifically assails religion. This goes on to say, the Yale response seems to imply that Allah is the same God that Christians worship. Is that true? Well, first of all, Christians do worship God, but the God that they worship isn't God. The real God has a name, it's Yahweh, and he does not want to be worshipped. But we'll play along here, and let's just go along with this idea that Christians do worship a God. Their God is almost always nameless. They ascribe a God to their Jesus, but the God of Christianity is nameless. And the God of Islam is named. The name is Allah. But let's see what they have to say. So the Yale Initiative seems to imply that Allah is the same God that Christians worship. Is that true? Now, the answer is absolutely not. But let's hear them out. The answer: implicit in this question are two sub-questions. Whether it is appropriate for Christians to call the God of the Bible Allah. And whether Muslims and Christians worship the same God. Regarding the first question, we do not hesitate to refer to the God of the Bible as Allah, as Arab Christians and Arabic-speaking Jews have done since the time before Muhammad used the name Allah to refer to God. That is not true. It's not true. First of all, there is no indication whatsoever of what anyone in Arabia called God or a name for God prior to Muhammad, because there was no written Arabic. So without a written language, we do not know. Now, did Allah exist before Muhammad? Absolutely. He was the largest, blackest stone in the Kaaba. So then the God named Allah was a god long before Muhammad. So that part is true, but that Allah is a stone god, the black stone of the Kaaba. Now, Christians didn't begin to use the name Allah for God until long after Islam was imposed. And they sought to survive in Islamic countries where the consequence of being a Christian was to be treated as an animal with no rights, by implying that their God was the same as the God of Islam. Now, it's not true. It was religious sleight of hand, but it is true that Christian Bibles replace Yahweh's name with Allah. Now, is there any legitimacy for doing so? Of course not. Is it absolute copy edit and sleight of hand and inappropriate? Absolutely. But this idea that it is appropriate for anyone to refer to God as Allah, you've got to be absolutely stark raving nuts. Now, it goes on to say, there is clearly nothing wrong or evil in the name Allah. It's the name chosen by the wannabe God of Islam. That God is absolutely evil. Wrong? Yes, it's not God's name. God says, I have, if you're going to deal with God's name, God's really clear. He says, I have one name. So if you use a name other than Yahweh, that would be wrong. So it is the opposite of what Yale is inferring here. God has but one name. His name is Yahweh. Allah would be wrong. As for evil, the depiction of Allah in the Quran is the living embodiment of evil. He is a wannabe deity that is a terrorist by his own admission, that is destructive and deadly by his own admission, that is into predestination by, so therefore no choice by his own admission, that is religious by his own admission, that is imposing himself on everyone and saying that if you do not submit to my imposition of my religion and of me upon you, I will see to it that you are tortured. A grievous punishment will await you in hell. And he is then depicted throughout the Quran as the one applying the tortures in hell, and they are explicit and they are perverse. He is the epitome of evil. Okay? And what's interesting is that Allah describes that which is good as halal. And yet halal happens to be the name Yahweh has given Satan. So what Yale is saying here, as is the case with most things that are politically correct, is absolutely and wholly incorrect. They next say, there is nothing wrong or evil in the name Allah. It is simply the Arabic word for God. Now, it's either a name or it's a word. So you can't call it a name if it is a word. Now, by the way, it is not the Arabic word for God. And anybody that knows anything about Arabic, anything about the Quran, knows it. So they are not presenting something out of naivete here. They know that they're lying in saying that Allah is the Arabic word for God. Il and Illah are the Arabic words for God. They are based on the Hebrew word for God, El, and Eloah. Allah is a name, and the Quran so designates it as such. Yale claims that all Arabic Christian Bible translations of John 3:16 say, "For Allah so loved the world." Well, first of all, if it's an Arabic translation, it doesn't say "for" or "so loved the world." That would be an English translation. As for it being a translation, you cannot translate God, Allah. Il would be the Arabic word for God. The Quran's really clear. In fact, even the Muslim profession of faith uses il and illah as the Arabic word for God. It does not use Allah. And the Quran is clear. It says that Allah is the one of the Islamic gods' names. And it says that Allah is the Arabic word for God. So they know the truth. They are deliberately lying. Then it says in Acts 20:11, when the Arab visitors to Jerusalem, and we don't know if there were any Arab visitors to Jerusalem, in fact, it would be unlikely if there were, heard the apostles declaring the mighty works of God in Arabic, why would they speak Arabic? I mean, who are they going to convince of the pagans? You know, they couldn't read Arabic. There's no way to memorialize anything that was said in Arabic. There was no written Arabic in the first century CE. There wouldn't be a written version of the language or any indication of that language for another 600 years. And on top of that, when the language was finally conceived using a written form, it was the Hebrew alphabet that was used to conceive it. And so the only reason that there's a commonality between Arabic words and Hebrew words is because written Arabic was based upon Hebrew, although 2,000 years thereafter. Kirk, you've spent some time reading the Torah. Do you find Allah in the Torah?
A word that means to rise up or lift up.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It also means to be arrogant, to be conceited, to be puffed up. Yeah. Yeah. It's it is a word that speaks of the very characteristics that caused Satan to be cast out of heaven.
I'll also think of it when he said, "I'll lift up my kingdom above yours or my throne above yours," sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
all the connotations are bad.
Right? Yeah, it's that is the very Hebrew word Allah. You know, I'm going to lift up myself and my kingdom and my name and above the Most High, and that's what Allah conveys in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. You know, why couldn't these morons at Yale and their divinity school. Tell the truth. And to say, you know, the Torah prophets and Psalms are clear. Yahweh's name is written 7,000 times. Yahweh introduces himself by name. He only has one name. His name is Yahweh. That's God's one and only name. Why couldn't these idiots tell the truth? Do you think they don't know that?
Of course they know that. It's the same problem. The reason this show is not on network TV or network radio everywhere is because they absolutely can't tell the truth.
Yeah, they don't want the truth to be known. Yeah, they don't want the truth to be known. The political correctness actually demands lies.
Mm-hmm.
It just demands lies. And everything they have written here is absolutely, unequivocally, demonstrably untrue.
And so pervasive, that's why people can't, when they hear this show, or they hear other shows, or they read it in all these different web pages now that are available to them, they just cannot believe it. I had a lady tell me the other day, she's really struggling with, surely there's more than a few thousand people that understand this. And I said, there's a lot of people that know it, but
right.
None of them embrace it. I mean,
right.
they won't embrace the truth.
Correct. Now, I think most people are just ignorant of the truth. Because they've been indoctrinated and they don't care enough to seek the truth. But there are lots of people. There's lots of people. Like, I would say for certain that the people who wrote this for Yale, the people who advanced this for Yale and their theology school, know absolutely that what they are writing is untrue and don't seem to care.
That's the answer.
All right. They know it's untrue. They don't seem to care. It's like our politicians. They know what they're saying is untrue. It doesn't bother them. There's a Machiavellian vein that runs through religious and political leaders where they view that the ends justify the means and therefore it is correct for them to lie. That's the basis of political correctness. It's why it is so corrosive.